spine.
And sprocket.
The book to read is not the one that thinks for you, but the one which makes you think.
A classic is a book that is never finished saying what it has to say.
No two persons ever read the same book.
That is part of the beauty of all literature. You discover that your longings are universal longings, that you're not lonely and isolated from anyone. You belong.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Spine and Sprocket.
I'm David Kleinschmidt.
I'm Mike Lemke.
I'm Jeff Hallett. We are your amazing hosts.
Or so say we.
So say we all. And tonight's literary treat is a reading of the Sword of Shannara.
It's a break from our usual military stuff.
There's some fighting, though.
There is some fighting.
And yeah, it's military.
Of battles military, also, right?
It's just not World War II.
It's not World War II, yeah.
Though if you worked hard, you could probably draw some metaphors to World War II.
And maybe he intended that. Who knows?
I didn't pick that up.
Like evil enemies, like
enchanted swords, stuff that...
That would be the tiger tanks.
That would be the tiger, yeah.
Yeah. And this is a rather lengthy novel by Terry Brooks, and this came out in about 1977. When I was just a lad. I remember when this came out. It was a featured Book of the Month Club selection.
Mine is signed by Terry Brooks.
Dave has a signed copy. How did
Except
you get that?
It also says The Shady Lady, which makes me remember, I think this is my sister, sister-in-law's book. I need to return it since 1977.
Hmm. It's I think legally it might be yours by now.
Yeah, I don't think you really need to return it. Does she know you have it?
I think she forgot.
Okay, this is working out really well.
Or she just gave it to me and said, I'll just keep it. I wish I could remember. But
well, it's very nice.
It's signed by Terry Brooks, 1977. Yeah.
Hmm. And it's printed on parchment.
Handwritten. Almost.
It's crumbling.
It's like one of those tomes that you'd see in Gondor.
Yes.
In the basement of Gondor, which... Interestingly enough, there was some controversy, if you can call it that, when this book came out, because 1977, The Lord of the Rings had been around for some years, but when this came out, there were a lot of people saying it was kind of a ripoff of The Lord of the Rings, and it was one of the first big fantasy novels to come out.
Yeah, I read that about the critic that said it was a scathing review, that it was just a complete ripoff of...
Yeah, I never read those reviews, but I remember not caring that much for it because I couldn't get beyond the Tolkien thing. Yeah, it's just a ripoff, you know. But I did go on and read the next two. I think I had read them. I don't have those still. And at the time, in defense, well, my friend who's doing another book podcast had stated how there was really no fantasy genre. Mm-hmm. Right before this, he was talking about Elric, Michael Moorcock,
right?
Conan.
Yeah.
Mm. You got this little stuff that was done for these magazines as fantasy writing.
Yeah.
And it really, there was no epic and there was no heroic, you know, because I think those things are seen more as grim, gritty sword and sorcery versus high fantasy, I think.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Whereas sword and sorcery is kind of low-level magic, and you know you don't get all these glorious cultures of elves. And well, although with Conan, you have these various places, big cities, and things, but there's always a grittiness to that.
Yeah,
that you don't.
You're right. That does make, because I had been reading some fantasy before this came out, other than Tolkien. Besides the one you mentioned, there was a series of books by Fritz Leiber about the characters of Fafhrd and Grey Mouser. There were five or six of those, these two heroes that were going around and, you know, sort of stuff that you would imagine Frank Frazetta had been drawing from and drawing. But this was the first one that kind of really started a huge movement of fantasy, I think. And I remember, It was a Book of the Month Club alternative or something, or Science Fiction and Fantasy Book Club, and I got it. And then I read the review that said this is a ripoff of Tolkien, and so I didn't read it.
Oh.
I didn't read it until last year, actually. I read it last year. And obviously there were some similarities, glaring similarities.
That we'll discuss as we go.
Yeah. But to me, it didn't really detract from the book. I didn't think, oh, I know what's coming next. It's going to be
a big spider. No, it wasn't like that. You know? Yeah.
Big spider. Named Shelob.
Yeah. And here comes, the wizard with the foppy hat. It wasn't like that. So I didn't have that much problem. I'll tell you what I did have a problem with, if we can just jump right in.
I was just going to say that the other guy I was talking to, who's a pretty much an expert on this, we really should have invited him in. He's starting, again, his own podcast, which we can link later if it's... because he's fanatic about all this.
Really? He's starting his own podcast?
Yeah.
Who is it?
Brad Archer.
Oh.
Yeah, Science Fiction Fantasy.
Okay.
Just hoping it would fail so he can come over and join us.
That's what I was thinking just now. Yeah, I hope it doesn't work out for him.
I'm sure he'll come and be a guest.
I didn't really want to verbalize that, but since you put it out there.
And he claimed that Brooks had sent this to Del Rey. He had just heard another podcast where they interviewed Terry Brooks.
Oh, really?
And that he had sent it to Del Rey, I guess as a real person.
Yeah.
Not just a publisher.
No, his name was Lester Del Rey.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
And they had done and he sent it back the manuscript, written all over, cut out, change 80% of this, change 60%. And I don't know the whole story of that. But I thought that was interesting to hear that it had gone through a lot of revisions with the publisher. And now, Jeffrey,
how about that?
Mike, you can jump.
And Mike, had you been reading fantasy in those days? Because
in those days, I read Lord of the Rings in high school.
Yeah.
So that was before this. And since then, I've read The Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan, some Brandon Sanderson. Not a lot of fantasy.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
And yeah, I think it was my second foray into it. And to be honest, the Tolkien... I loved it so much that when I did read Wizard of Earthsea or other relatives started saying, oh, these books are recommended. You like fantasy. I was almost like, no, I don't really like fantasy.
I like Tolkien, yeah.
I like Lord of the Rings.
Middle Earth, yeah.
Really, because I'd come out of a horror Universal Monster gig for a long time. I liked dinosaurs and first animals and then dinosaurs and then Universal horror films. Through high school, started to get into the Tolkien thing. Yeah. And then the military thing came in college. Mm-hmm. So.
What, you got into the military?
Thing.
Oh, games.
Yes.
Games.
One of our mutual
historical
gaming friends is really into Tolkien. He's got the Tolkien books, and then he's got a whole bookshelf like that full of critics and critiques and background. And there's so much written on Tolkien and Middle Earth and the whole world. And so.
Yeah, I have like three buried over there. Oh, by the way, we're in my basement tonight, so if you're here instead of Jeff's house, so if you hear different noises in the background, we're just going to say...
It's a different cell phone.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a different cell phone. Well, the book, it's a big one, 600, 700 pages.
27, because finished yesterday.
I probably won't be recommending another one of this size
for
this show.
Not for a while, although Mike's read several books since then.
Yeah, Mike's a good reader. I was having a hard time keeping up.
But I was busy editing, so.
Yeah. But to just real quickly what the story is about, is about a couple of young men, brothers, who are living a life of a quiet life in a quiet little village, in a quiet little part of the world that we later find out is Earth in the future.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Which, and I'm going to stop right there because that really threw me. The first time I read this a year ago, that totally passed me by. I did not realize that at all.
Did you remember that, Mike, that it was Earth?
It's in the book.
Was this the first time you read this book?
First time I read it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you too?
Did you catch it?
Well, you had already told me that, so
okay.
I knew it was coming.
I spilled the beans. All right. Well, I totally missed it the first time because they didn't make a big deal out of it, and maybe I'm just not a very good reader.
Well, and it is so much different. I mean, it's got all the different races that you
Yeah.
You know, you would expect to be part of some fantasy world, not Earth.
Exactly.
So how did they come about? I don't know. It's not a clear explanation of how all these races sort of developed. At least it wasn't to me.
It was briefly explained in okay. that the mankind, some had gone underground to survive. It's a post-nuclear, right? Right.
Yeah.
So some went underground to survive, and I think they became the dwarves who eventually moved back up the surface of the earth. And
right.
Gnomes went a different direction. And yeah, so everyone, it was briefly mentioned like that.
Okay.
That mankind got all decimated and split up.
Okay.
And he didn't use the word evolved, but.
But knowing a little about how evolution works, I was kind of stuck with that because I don't think that would have turned out that way. But.
And coincidentally, it's all the races that you find in Middle Earth.
Yes.
That yeah, like?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, what a surprise.
And, it really was a and surprise. And when you read between the lines in Middle Earth, you also discovered that Tolkien had all these races come from man in a post-nuclear apocalypse.
And when you read between the lines?
Yeah. Like
really between.
So in that way, his book is very original.
Yeah,
very original.
If you smoke some of the long bottom leaf before you start reading, I think you can probably pull all kinds of stuff out of there. But, you know, this is what's interesting to me is that once I learned that it was a post-apocalyptic Earth, kind of wrecked the book.
No way.
Yeah, wrecked really? It for me.
For
wrecked
me?
It. Wrecked
for,
it.
What'd you think, Mike?
Oh, no, that didn't wreck it for me. I mean, it helped explain that one section where they were going through the woods and they saw the old buildings and the runes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, those were probably...
Old Earth.
Yeah, old Earth. Yeah, pre-nuclear war Earth. So, I guess it didn't wreck it for me.
No, I thought it kind of gave it that anti-Tolkien twist that I didn't notice the first time I read it or felt it wasn't enough to get over the Tolkien thing. That it worked for me. I'm like, oh, okay, this is even better now. Mm-hmm. now it's more original of a world.
Well, that's true. But it just threw me off because I like to read fantasy. If I'm going to read fantasy, I like to read fantasy. And I got then when I found out it wasn't really like fantasy, it was more like science fiction in that way.
Well, where do you classify it then? Fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know still. How picky I am. It's really annoying how picky I am.
Yeah, you only let me be your friend on alternate months. Yeah,
that's right. And it's not this month.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Do I have to leave now? Wait, it's my house. You have to leave.
Well, to get us back on track, so these couple guys are living in this very...
We digress.
We did digress kind of a little bit, didn't we? So they're living here, and lo and behold, somebody shows up and says, hey...
Al-Anon.
Hey there, young
Al-Anon.
Man. Yeah, Al-Anon.
And he grabs him by the throat in the woods and lifts him off the ground.
Flick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The two main characters are Flick and Shay.
That's the way I like to introduce myself to people.
Yeah, picking him up off the ground. Yeah, that was a little bit... I felt like the writer was a little bit cumbersome at the first opening chapters.
Meaning what?
Well, like that scene, there was a lot of... one moment he's... very mysterious and threatening and even choking him. And then a moment later, he's nice and laughing.
Yeah.
And
Yeah. There were several passages like that where I just didn't get it. Like, why is the character doing that now? You know, I just didn't, I don't know.
Do you have other examples?
I can't think of anything right now, but there was several that were just... didn't seem right somehow. The motivation didn't seem there.
Yes, I agree with you on
that. So it seemed a little cumbersome in that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Al-Anon comes to them and says there are bad things brewing in the world. And these guys are living in a pretty secluded area, kind of like the Shire.
In the Southland.
The Southland, mm-hmm. And it's peaceful there. And so they really don't know much about what else is going on in the world. But Al-Anon comes and says, hey, there's some bad stuff going on in this dark power is coming down from the north, and oh, by the way, you are the heir to the one thing that can defeat the dark powers, which is this sword mm-hmm. from Shannara. And so instead of a ring, we have a sword that
the quest
is kind of asked mm-hmm. after.
And instead of Gandalf, we have Al-Anon.
Yeah.
Gandalf's
obviously Al-Anon. The wizard guy appears in the Shire, right?
And Shay, it turns out, is half elvish.
Mm-hmm. And that little gnome guy is like the Gollum, the little
yes
that grabs the sword and
Olaf or
Yes.
Fern. Olaf is frozen, isn't it? Fern. It's the little yes. Snowman man in Frozen.
You're right there.
I just finished this yesterday. The little gnome guy, we'll call him that.
Yeah.
Oh. You call him Olaf.
And so, of course, the first thing you have to do.
The name started with an O, though.
I think it did, yeah.
Yeah. So they start to. So they head off on this quest. Well, they can't stay where they are because they're afraid that the dark powers are going to come and find them, because the only way the dark powers can really take over is to kill the last living heir of Shannara.
Correct.
And that would be Shay.
Yes. So they have to flee. Yes.
So they need to flee.
So I wrote.
Yeah, go ahead.
A comment here. Page 42, first paragraph. I'll read a little bit. Alanon's plan for further discussions at the inn did not work out. He left the brothers sitting in a hushed conversation behind the inn and returned to his room. Shay and Flick finally went back to their chores, and shortly thereafter were dispatched on an errand by their father that took him out of the Vale. It was dark. By the time they returned, they hastened to the dining room, hoping to question the historian further, but he did not appear. And I wrote, aren't you supposed to, like, show it, don't tell it? Did any of you guys think about that?
Yeah, I did have some of that show it, yeah, where they were telling it.
Like, yeah, like he writes out all the action in paragraphs instead of just doing it like a story with dialogue and everything else. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought at times there were scenes that were well-described and long, and then other parts that were should have been maybe shown and not told.
Yeah.
Storyteller. Maybe.
Okay.
Does anybody remember what reading about when the Shay and Flick and Menyon were off? So later on, so they go off. Okay. Mm-hmm. I won't get ahead of
the myself. Dark thing comes.
Yeah, the dark thing comes. The skull cruiser. No, the skull. No.
Skull bearer?
Skull bearer,
yeah.
Which is a dark thing not too far from a...
Nazgul.
From a Nazgul, yeah.
All right.
Comes and scares them, and so they need to head off right away. So they head off, and they head toward a friend that Shay has in a nearby...
Kingdom.
Kingdom. Yeah. Menyon, who happens to be a prince.
Leia or Lee?
Lee. L-E-A-H, Lee. Mm. Menyon Lee.
Menyon Lee from the Lee Castle. He's a prince.
Yeah. So they head off looking. They pick up Lee and they say, "Hey, we're going on a quest. Want to come?" And Lee's like, "Yeah, I'm a prince. I'm not doing much. I'm kind of hanging loose, having some crazy adventures. Not really doing much or paying much attention to my lineage. So sure, I'll go with you." And they take off. Well, at one point they get separated in the fog, and
that's the forest, the mist march. Mist marsh.
Mm-hmm. Before they get to that river.
Yes.
And in the description, how can I put this? Shay and Flick get rescued.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a very long backstory about what happened to Menyon.
Correct.
Which really threw me off. And yes. I don't want to just dwell on the stuff that I didn't like about the book. Though that's normal for me.
Being as picky as you are.
Yeah, being as picky as I am. Yeah. I just thought it was weird, but it goes back to this show us, don't tell us.
Yeah, it was like, I'm going to tell you all
the stuff that
instead
happened.
Instead of telling it like story, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they meet up with Menyon, and then they get rescued by the dwarves, which is very handy. Menyon gets entangled in some bad roots.
Yeah.
Which is similar to what happens to the guys in Lord of the Rings, where they almost get eaten by a tree. And that's when Tom Bombadil comes by. Remember that part where they're sleeping next to
him? I do. Yeah. I love Tom Bombadil.
Yeah. I was hoping Tom Bombadil.
Bombadil's a calming. Hey, Mary, Mary doll, Mary doll rolling. It's pretty close to the Tolkien stuff.
Yeah, that's good. That's like, just the way he wanted it sung.
I actually had an album of him reading and singing his work.
You did, really?
Yes.
Singing.
I had.
Yes, he would
there break are a lot into of songs these little in the books,
He'd break into those little tra la 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 lee, I was done in the valley. He'd kind of sing song it.
Yeah, oh, that's cool. I'd love it to hear that.
Yeah, I think I have it on a cassette now over there, but my cassette.
I didn't know there was any of that. I thought the only recordings, the only official recordings of Lord of the Rings stuff were like the Ballad of Frodo Baggins by Leonard Nimoy.
Yes, I remember.
Or no, Bilbo. Bilbo Baggins. Bilbo Baggins, rolling down the street.
The Rankin stuff was
pretty
okay.
Bass pretty horrible. Rankin.
But I'll find it for you guys.
That'd be good.
Talk to you.
So they go, they meet the dwarves, who are a bunch of short guys. And they meet a guy very much like
Tough Gimli. Guys, though.
Tough guy, yes. Very stout and tough and carry big battle axes. And then where do they go from there? They move on
then
to...
Well, then Elanon comes back, doesn't he?
Yeah,
to that back. Dwarf city.
Right.
And then they set up the party that goes out adventuring to the north. Yeah,
the official quest.
The official quest, yeah.
To go to Paranor.
Right.
Which is where the sword is hid or kept, has been kept all these years. And really, so their quest is to go get the sword and to use that. Well, first of all, to just keep Brana, the evil Dark Lord, from getting it. But second of all, to hopefully defeat him.
My friends.
The deep voice of Al-Anon boomed out in the slight stir of voices as he rose commandingly to his full height of 7 feet. The room was instantly silent as all faces turned in his direction.
I must now tell you what I have as yet told no one else. We have suffered a tragic loss.
He paused and looked at the anxious faces in return.
Paranor has fallen. A division of gnome hunters under the command of the warlock lord has seized the sword of Shannara.
There was dead silence for about 2 seconds before the dwarves were on their feet shouting in anger. Balinor rose quickly in an effort to quiet them. Shay and Flick looked at each other in disbelief. Only Menion seemed unsurprised by the announcement, his lean face carefully scrutinizing the dark figure at the head of the table.
Paranor was taken from within.
Al-Anon continued after some semblance of order had been restored.
There is little question as to the fate of those who guarded the fortress and the sword. I am told that all were executed. No one knows exactly how it happened.
Have you been there?
Shay asked suddenly, feeling almost immediately that it was a stupid question.
I left your home in the Vale so suddenly because I received word that an attempt would be made to secure Paranor. I have arrived too late to help those within and barely escaped detection myself. That is one of the reasons I am so late in reaching Cullhaven.
But if Paranor has fallen and the sword been taken...
Flick's whispered question trailed off ominously.
Then what can we do now?
Al-Anon finished harshly.
This is the problem facing us, the one we must provide an immediate answer for, the reason for this council.
Balinor had risen and indicated he wished to speak to those assembled. Al-Anon nodded and sat down.
I do not understand the power of the sword over the warlock lord. That much I freely admit.
The tall warrior began.
But I do know the threat that we all face if Brona's army invades the Southland, and the Einar, as our reports indicate, it is preparing to do. My homeland will be the first to face this threat, and if I can prevent it in any way, then I cannot do otherwise. I will go with Al-Anon.
The dwarfs leaped up again at this point and enthusiastically shouted their support. Al-Anon stood up and raised his long arm in a plea for silence.
These two young elves at my side are cousins of Eventine. They will accompany me, for their stake in this matter is at least as great as your own. Balinor will go as well, and I will take one of the dwarf chieftains, no more. This must be a small, highly skilled party of hunters if we are to succeed. Pick the best man among you, and let him come with us.
He looked at the end of the table, where Shay and Flick sat watching in a mixed state of shock and confusion. Menion Lee had pondered quietly, looking at no one in particular. Al-Anon glanced expectantly at Shay, his grim face suddenly softening as he saw the frightened eyes of the young Veilman who had come so far, through so many dangers, to this apparent haven of safety, only to be told that he was expected to leave it for an even more perilous trip northward. But there had been no time to break the news to the Veilman in a gentle way. He shook his head doubtfully and waited.
I think I had better go.
The abrupt declaration came from Menion, who had again risen to his feet to face the others.
I came with Shade this far to be certain he reached the safety of Cullhaven, which he has done. My duty to him is finished, but I owe it to my homeland and to my people to protect them in any way I can.
What can you offer, then?
asked Al-Anon abruptly, astonished that the Highlander would volunteer without first speaking to his friends. Shay and Flick were clearly dumbfounded by this unexpected announcement.
I'm the best bowman in the Southland.
Mannion answered smoothly.
Probably the best tracker as well.
Al-Anon seemed to hesitate for a moment, then looked to Balinor, who quietly shrugged. For a brief moment, Mannion and Al-Anon locked gazes, as if to judge each other's intentions. Mannion smiled coldly at the grim historian.
Why should I answer to you?
He queried shortly. The dark figure at the other end of the table stared at him almost curiously, and a deathly silence settled over the company. Even Balinor stepped back one short pace in shock. Shay knew instantly that Mannion was asking for trouble, and that everyone at the table except the three companions knew something about the foreboding Al-Anon. The frightened Veilman shot a quick look at Flick, whose flushed face had gone pale at the thought of a confrontation between the two men. Desperate to avoid any trouble, Shay stood up suddenly and cleared his throat. Everyone looked in his direction, and his mind went blank.
"Have you something to say?"
demanded Al-Anon blackly. Shay nodded, and his mind raced desperately, knowing what was expected. He looked to Flick, who managed a barely perceptible nod, indicating that he would go along with whatever his brother decided. Shay cleared his throat a second time.
"My special skill appears to be that I was born in the wrong family, but I had better see this matter through. Flick and I, Mannion too, will go to Paranor."
Al-Anon nodded his approval and even managed a slight smile, inwardly pleased with the young Veilman. Shay, more than any of the others, had to be strong. He was the last son of the House of Shannara, and the fate of so many would depend on that single small chance of birth.
Right.
And they don't know how to do this.
No, Shay is very hesitant, very nervous. He hasn't contributed much. Even Flick saved somebody at some point, but Shay hadn't done anything yet, right?
Yeah, right.
Until they got way into it in Paranor.
Yeah. Yeah, Shay thinking that maybe he's going to jump in and do something heroic.
Yeah.
Waiting and waiting and waiting. This reminds me of another fantasy series that came out not too long after this, The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever by Stephen mm-hmm. Donaldson, which were very good books, but I hated them. Because the main character was so hesitant through all three. I think finally in the third book, like, he whips out his gold ring and opens up a can of, you know, whoop ass. But you got to go through like 900 pages before it happens.
Yeah.
So I was feeling a little of that. Come on, Shay.
He's just along for the ride, it seems, for a lot of it.
He and his brother, the big guys, are taking him along, escorting him, which I was okay with that, actually, though. I did make a note back when they were describing about the dwarves, men becoming dwarves. I have that here on page 25. But on page 29, I noticed with his language, I was noticing, the author, Brooks, he says, you know, well, so little, though. What you say is true enough. Truisms, my young friend, are the useless children of hindsight. Well, I don't propose to argue with you now on the fine points of social reform, let alone political activism. Does that sound like...
Yeah.
Fantasy language?
Now, I was wondering where that came from. I thought maybe somebody dropped that in there in the printing room, like got something mixed up.
Well, he was a lawyer, right? Terry Brooks.
Was he?
He was writing this. This was his first book, and he was writing it in law school just to, I don't know how you do that, go to law school and write a novel, but just to prove to himself that he could write.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I noticed his... in his dedication, is that the right word? For my parents who believed, you know, mm-hmm. I think I believed in him being able to write a book.
Ah, yeah,
didn't believe in dwarves and gnomes.
No, I didn't take it.
Or they might. Maybe they did.
Maybe he meant it that way.
But thanks to my crazy parents.
Yeah, and that's where I was. Of course, thinking, you know, Tolkien was so gifted a linguist and a professor of languages that it's hard to compete.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Well, and I did notice that too. If I can rail. A little bit.
Sure.
And I recently reread Lord of the Rings, and I was noticing, this is about my third time through it, how every single passage is beautiful language. Mm. And every time somebody says something, it's like Shakespeare. Mm. And in this... There were really
didn't get that at all.
There were no noticeable speeches. There were so few points where I thought, "Wow, that was well said."
I thought awesome. Were kind of trying to be profound. Comments about war near the end and stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, but boy, I don't know. It just didn't work for me.
Not as well. No.
I mean, there's no backstory. There's no philosophy. I think Lord of the Rings had a lot more of that. And the other thing that I've read is the Wheel of Time. But I don't know. This just didn't feel like there was a lot of depth and meat to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Did you read all of Wheel of Time? All 15 books or whatever it is?
There's 14.
14.
I didn't read the last three yet, the Brandon Sanderson books. Okay. Yeah, I read the 11 Robert Jordan books, and now I still haven't started the beginning of the end yet. So.
Oh, okay.
But you need a reread strategy because you have to start, because I started 20 years ago or whatever. Yeah. So now I have to figure out how I'm going to reread them. There's all sorts of websites and forums about how to reread the Wheel of Time.
Yeah, that's right. And there are, if you go to Tor, I don't know if you ever go to Tor.com. Tor is a publisher of fantasy and science fiction, and they often have a reread. So you can read along with, and then this person, they'll have one person that rereads a book, and every week they'll post a blog post of what they read, and then there'll be comments back and forth. And you can go back and do all the rereads with them, because they, obviously it's on the internet. You can go back into the historical stuff. So
I felt like I had a hard time getting through the first couple hundred pages of this because it felt like just one sort of episode after another. I was thinking that, Dave's Dungeon and Dragon Friday nights would be more interesting.
Well, there's no guarantee about that.
I would say they are more interesting. Yeah.
So I got into the characters. After you're spending so much time with them, I started to care about them, and then I was, the battle scenes and all was fun, and the final confrontation was interesting and unique and kind of not what I expected. So that all made it. I think the second half was better than the first half for me. Just getting into it was a little bit of a struggle. It felt like a children's book almost,
like a little adventure, and he was introducing us to the little parts on his map. I think I felt we had to walk through the areas in the map. I did like Kelset the troll near the end.
I was going to say the one character I really liked was Kelset the rock troll.
Right.
I don't know why. Good. What? He didn't talk, did he?
He was mysterious. There was mysterious, stuff mysterious. Yeah. There was stuff that was left concealed.
Yes. And that's it. Yeah.
Because a lot of the other characters, too, didn't have a whole lot of depth to them.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. And so then he brought that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the battle scenes, I thought he did a pretty good description of battle scenes.
I agree.
So if we watch Lord of the Rings, right, the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was really disappointed in with the Jackson, Phil Jackson.
You were? Andrew Peter Jackson?
Peter Jackson.
You were disappointed in the movies?
Only.
Oh.
No, they were. I was very glad he ended up doing what he did. But in the idea that they, the battle scenes ended up being these two mega long lines of thousands upon thousands of creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That then just went straight at each other, and having played ancient miniatures war games with miniature figures, and you're in units and you're turning to flank and your bowmen are pulling this direction and you're trying to draw them in. He actually covered that.
Yeah.
He talked about
shifting a flank. A lot of tactical stuff,
Some nice tactics that's historically, real Earth historically accurate to ancients, which is what you should draw from when you're doing a fantasy battle that's medieval.
Yep.
Right? Or ancient. Although he did have the two enemy flanks, he had the friendly cavalry pull out of the center as the enemy was trying to surround them, and then the two evil sides clashed in the middle and fought each other.
That seemed a little preposterous.
I missed that.
Must have been.
No, it was like a opposite of Hannibal and Cannae.
Yeah.
It was like he somehow pushed. Somehow he let their flanks
come around
him.
That's for the obscure historical reference that I do not
Hannibal,
get.
Come on.
I got it.
Hannibal.
I know Hannibal.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Hannibal, he let his center come in.
Right.
And then his flanks were ready to pounce on the Romans when they rushed in the center and the flanks, boom.
Okay.
This was the opposite. It was like...
Yeah, you fake like your middle guys are all running away. Oh, and then well, they chase them sort in. Of,
they must have had to go forward, think, or how did they I do think, it? Because like, then the enemy flanks came around and ended up attacking each other. Well, which
yeah, because the horsemen pulled out of the middle.
Oh, well, they go like back pulling towards the tablecloth. Lines? Okay.
Yes.
Kind of like pulling the tablecloth out.
Yeah.
And all the glassware is still there.
I thought, man, these are really stupid trolls or whatever they were.
I think it was that
starting to kill each other.
Was that in the really dark part, though, too?
It was at night or
yeah,
whatever it was, but yeah.
Anyway. Right, and they had taken some advantage of that.
Oh.
And so I did make a few what's up with that, which I wasn't going to make this a running thing.
Now's a segment we like to call what's up with that,
Okay. Did you look at the map? Where are the Black Oaks?
The Black Oaks.
They are not labeled.
They're not on the map?
Okay.
Okay, what's up with that?
I want my money back.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
What's up with that? You're making a whole map for your fantasy world. I think these are the Black Oaks by the Mist Marsh.
Yeah, that's where they are.
Well, does it say Black Oaks, Jeff?
No. Well, you're just supposed to know.
Well, label
it. It might have in my Del Rey copy.
What copy do I have?
I read paperback from that I got from the library.
I have Random House, New York. Random House.
That's got to be like the first.
It is first edition, yeah. Signed by the author.
Yeah. No, it's very nice.
Or signed by an imposter.
And oh no, let's continue. What's up with that number two? I only have three. Page 98. Climbing gloves. Do you remember him climbing up the tree?
In the Black Oaks?
In the Black Oaks, I
think.
Oh,
Flick. Okay. Flick climbing the tree? Yeah, with some dexterity, as I recall.
Dexterity, but the interesting part was that his climbing gloves had special sticky stuff on them.
Oh, I do remember that.
I remember that part.
I do remember that.
Got it. He pulled on the heavy, flexible boots and gloves, which Shay had then coated with a thick, pasty substance from a small container. Menyon looked on quizzically, but his curiosity changed to astonishment as the stocky veilman grasped the base of the large tree with dexterity that belied both his bulky size and the difficulty of the task, proceeded to climb rapidly toward the summit. Which is cool, but I wouldn't just say a thick, pasty substance from a small container.
Hey.
Is this pasta?
I'm going to climb a tree. Bring the thick, pasty stuff.
Yeah.
Did you bring it? Yeah, of course. I don't go anywhere without it.
So I'm like, what's up with that? Just say it's like it's sap from a tree.
Yeah.
I come up with something.
Yeah.
The special tortoise manure that mixed with
some color or
yak urine,
some
gives it.
Yeah, but the whole thing is just dumb. I mean, I guess it just helps him grip.
But you don't need it. Did you need it?
No, you didn't need that.
Climb a tree.
Don't need to know that.
But it was kind of intriguing.
Because my thing
could have been intriguing.
If it's sticky enough to stick when you grab it,
I know where you're going.
How do you let go?
Oh.
Oh, well,
I wouldn't get. I'd never get.
It's fantasy though, so it's.
Oh, that's part of fantasy.
No, you're right, Jeff. I read it wrong.
He gets stuck.
He pulled on the heavy, flexible boots and gloves, which Shay then coated with a thick, pasty substance from a small container. Menyon looked on amazed as Shay then could not remove himself from the tree.
The book could have ended right there.
That could have been it.
And Shay was never heard from again.
No, epilogue.
Yeah.
Years later, some children playing in the woods found a skeleton in an odd pair of gloves and boots still clinging to a tree.
With a sticky substance of unknown
origin. With a small
origin.
Container of...
Yeah.
And his feet. Okay. And one more what's up with that. But any Tolkien fans here? Isn't Durin a dwarven name?
Isn't Durin a dwarven name?
Durin?
Oh, yes.
Durin and Dale. Durin is one of the ancestors of, like, Balin or Dwalin or...
But in this one, they're elves.
They're elves.
Right, okay.
So I'm like, what's up with that? You can't take Durin as an elvish name? Come on. Although, I guess...
I have kind of a what's up with that.
Okay.
Well, you look at the map. Didn't it take them, like, 3 days to go from one end to the other? It's like, this is like Cook County. Is that how big it is? I didn't get that. I thought, like, this isn't really... How many days did it take them to get from Shady Vale to the dwarf place, the dwarf city?
It might have been 3 days.
Yeah, 2 days. It does seem like it went pretty yeah. quick.
But his world can be small, but maybe we're used to bigger. But I know I can.
But if
I,
it's that small, notice. You know what? You should be knowing what's going on
around the world.
Yeah.
Around the world. Yeah.
Of course, you could live in Chicago.
Well, that's true.
Two blocks you over. Could. That's you true. Could live in a nice spot, and two blocks over, it's not yeah. so good. Maybe well, it's like that. It's
and it's interesting from a gaming perspective. My world I made in Dungeons & Dragons, I guess we're now admitting I played D&D on this podcast.
The big reveal.
The squares. Dun, dun, dun. I drew it all out on a map, a square map instead of hexagons, which works fine.
Yeah.
But I didn't make a scale until like much later. And then I made it like 40 miles per square. So yeah. I noticed at some point I changed the scale down. I cheated it down a little because it took a long
Taking
time to
too
get
long.
Places.
Yeah. yeah.
But on the other hand, your characters, if you're playing a lot of games where they adventure, come home, head out like the next day and the yeah. next they were never aging
yeah
you know
yeah
so I started to make it where oh you're traveling over to there I'm going to lean back toward the 40 miles per square and it's going to yeah. take you a week to get to the Elven village and two yeah. months to get to the coast
right
and then if you're sailing across you know you're
that seems like an appropriate scale
a year later everyone comes back from the adventure happy birthday everyone you're now another
yeah.
year older
yeah that
and
makes
I like,
sense
I like that better for that but anymore what's up with that
no well
that's you know we'll have to I'll have to keep that in mind for the future
the what's what, up with that
the what's up with
yeah
that.
No it's a good idea
because there were a lot of places but I didn't make any notes on those
well I didn't intend for it to become a running gag on the show
yeah, but it
maybe
should be.
I think it should be
maybe it should be Ooh. And I just thought there was one thing he overuses adjectives wait no See, who am I to comment? I don't even know language use.
Yeah.
Page 621. Almost casually.
Oh, almost casually.
He almost casually
yeah.
walked to the tree. Page 600. And then Minion gave an almost instant response.
Mm. Wow.
You didn't catch that stuff?
No, I kind of missed that.
Page 72, line 5. Somewhat discontented.
Mm. Yeah.
And I could have written...
Yeah.
20 more. Once I was really aware of
yeah.
it, I'm like, what? Almost. And I told this to Brad, the guy I was talking about earlier, and he said, yeah, it's kind of like, go ahead, Brooks, just commit.
Yeah.
He said it well. Just commit. He was casual. It was an instant response.
Right.
Almost
right.
instant. And it's in there a lot. And so then once I became aware of it, it started to bug me.
Mm.
You know, I'm like, where's the editor? He just had to go through and cut out all those, what do they call, qualifying
yeah, adjectives? I think that's I it. And, you know, it's. I did not notice that. But what I did notice in reading, and I think Mike alluded to it, was that there was no sense of immediacy in any of the writing. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of want to know what happens,
mm-hmm.
but you don't, but there was no anxiety. I had no anxiety about anything that was going on through all of the narrative because it was so kind of blasé because of that. It had been so yeah. watered down.
Yeah, just not that
adding
deep
words.
Somehow. Yeah.
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 And it's not that, and it's so interesting to me because I can't quite put my finger on it, but you can read other things that have lots of description that are really interesting to read. And then there are mm-hmm. things with lots of description that are not interesting to read. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
how about that?
Here's a line.
That's...
Well, I'll get back to some positive things, too, and we should continue the storyline to insert the
yeah.
audios
right.
that I made.
So that they make sense.
And if they don't, we'll just cram them in.
Yeah.
But he told Shay that in time, when the homelands of so many people were threatened, no one stopped to question why another was there to aid them. It was merely accepted.
Yeah.
I'm like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, there's evil around, and
yeah,
but times are troubled, so this character shows up. I think it was what Mike was saying. Some of it just didn't sit quite right, or the motivations.
Yeah.
Well, that's the motivation. It's times of trouble, so you would just always accept someone else to help you. You wouldn't question it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you would still. Or you know,
you would, I think, yeah.
Life's not that simple.
It's not that simple, and it's not, you know, the way the world was segregated into the elves lived over mm-hmm. here, and the dwarves lived over here, and the humans lived over here. And they don't really interact with each other. That just didn't really make sense to
no.
me much either.
No.
That, you know, because when there's people around, there's going to be commerce and all kinds of stuff
right.
going on.
Yeah, but the race war part I thought was a good idea.
Yeah.
I liked the old Earth concepts and so on.
Well, I'm glad you did.
In my book.
Oh, you've got a nice, picture there. Wow.
From the brothers Hildebrand.
Hildebrand illustrated this original version. Yeah. And this also then, it really got me like, oh, Hildebrand brothers. I love this stuff from the calendars, you know,
yeah.
In the 77, 78. But then on the other hand, it also served for me to go, Tolkien ripoff. It's the Hildebrand brothers.
Yeah.
Which is unfair. But it has this nice illustration of the Fellowship of the Ring.
The Fellowship.
The party heading out. And a cover illustration with the sword being pulled and the troll there. I think.
Right.
No, it was up there. And there's black and white ones. The weird thing is they don't pop up really well in this old version. They're in here, but you can flick through. Oh, there's one.
Oh, yeah.
There's the skull.
Oh, moment. Right. Yes, okay. I have some of those in my... Yeah. I read the electronic version. And it had some of the illustrations in it. Not a lot of them, but it did have a few.
Did the illustrations in yours look like Pac-Man or something? The pixels?
Yeah. Yes. They were all made with X's and O's.
So, the storyline, right? He.
So off they go on their quest, and they get...
the dwarven thing.
Where do they get separated? They get separated.
They had to go through the Tomb of the Kings.
Right.
They get separated before that, though, don't they?
No, I thought they all made it through the Tomb of the Kings. Yeah. What was described like this?
Years ago, before the First War of the Races, a cult of men whose origins had been lost in time served as priests for the gods of the Yggdrasil. Within these caverns, they buried the monarchs of the four lands, along with their families, servants, favorite possessions, and much of their wealth. The legend grew that only the dead could survive within these chambers, and only the priests were permitted to see that the dead rulers were interred. All others who entered were never seen again. In time, the cult died out, but the evil instilled in the Hall of Kings continued to exist, blindly to serve the priests whose bones had years before returned to the earth. Few men have ever passed. I have been through the Hall of the Kings, I alone from this age, and now you. I am a druid, the last to walk the earth, like Brennan, like Brona before him. I have studied the black arts, and I am a sorcerer. I do not possess the power of the Dark Lord, but I can get us safely through these caverns to the other side of the dragon's teeth. A narrow cliff trail, men call the Dragon's Crease, leads downward out of the mountains. Once there, we within sight of Paranor. Beyond this entrance, there are a number of passages and chambers, a maze to one who does not know the way. Some of these are dangerous, some are not. Soon after we enter, we will reach the Tunnel of the Sphinxes, giant statues like these centuries, but carved as half-man, half-beast. If you look into their eyes, you will be turned to stone instantly. So you must be blindfolded. In addition, you will be roped to one another. Concentrate on me. Think only of me, for their will, their mental command is strong enough to force you to tear off the blindfolds and gaze into their eyes. Once past the Sphinxes, there are several harmless passages leading into the Corridor of the Winds, a tunnel inhabited by invisible beings called Banshees, after the legendary astral spirits. They are no more than voices, but those voices will drive mortal men insane. Your ears will be bound for protection, but again, the important thing for you to do is to concentrate on me. My mind blanket yours to prevent it from receiving the full force of those voices. You must relax. Do not fight me. Do you understand? Once beyond the Corridor of the Winds, we will be in the Tomb of the Kings.
So they go through that place of the kings, which had the cliff and the... What else was in there? The dangers of the... Well, we just heard it described.
Yeah.
And the wind and the...
Yeah, the wind.
Like Sphinx things and the sculptures and the... And I thought that was pretty nice. You know, I was imagining all of that. And then the trauma hit, right? And they went ahead to the next portion. Was that where they met the gnomes? The gnome army? Or they split... The rocks came. The creature came out of the water.
Yeah.
And the creature started banging the rocks. and Al-Anon zapped it.
Right. That was still in the Tomb of the Kings, wasn't it?
Yeah. Did they split then, or they all came out alive?
No, they came out of that, and didn't they make it to Paranor together? Or no, Shay was separated from them by that point.
Right. Right, because they got Shay to the before. They got to the Gnome Pass.
Yes.
And the Gnome Army was there, and he shot the arrow in his butt.
Right.
Yeah, and that's when some of them were on the left side and some of them got through the pass. And Al-Anon had already left again.
Yep.
Right? To leave and come back again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they got through the gnome thing. And then that's when they were split up.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got to Paranor.
Yeah, the main group with Al-Anon and Flick and Balinor, they were all in Paranor. But then Shay hooked up with the thief and the troll.
Right.
Kelset, right. Right. And I thought the thief was an interesting character, too.
Oh, the two, yeah, those two are the most interesting characters.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. We all agree on that. And I thought it was weird that, though, that Al-Anon and the group decided, okay, well, we've lost Shay. We'll go on. I'm sure we'll catch up with him somewhere, was sort of the attitude of it. And while I kind of get that, I also think, wow, he's like the most important character in this group.
Yeah, according to Al-Anon, I mean, they had no chance without Shay.
Even more so than Frodo, because Frodo could have handed the ring to somebody else and somebody else could have carried it.
Correct.
But here, they needed Shay.
It had to be Shay,
because he was the last living
descendant. Maybe Al-Anon knew something. I don't know. He had some power, you know, some powers that maybe he knew that Shay was okay, or I don't know.
Possibly. We didn't really get into Al-Anon's from his frame of reference very much at all.
The whole druidic thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I kind of like Al-Anon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You didn't
from
like
the him? Well, I got better. He got better as the story went on? Do you think so?
Yes, I do. I would say that. But I will also have another confession, which is, for those people that don't know, it's Sword of Shannara has been adapted for television and is currently running as a series on MTV, of all things.
Okay.
It's an original series on MTV. So, and that was one of the reasons that I thought we should read this book, because it's sort of in the public eye now. People are...
Is this book being...
So this is the book that...
That's making up the series.
It's not.
The Elfstones,
it's the Elfstones. It's actually the second book.
Second book, okay.
That it's about. But the characters now, which I used to paint in my head, are now painted for me by... Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The individuals who are playing the characters on the show.
Right.
So I'm seeing John Rhys-Davies as Eventide, the King of the Elves.
Okay. I thought he was a dwarf.
And no, he's an elf.
In this one?
Yes, he's an elf.
Does he pull it off okay? Does that work for you?
It's okay. I have a problem with it. And then everybody else, you know.
I would not have cast
that. Al-Anon is an interesting choice. That actor is also played in Arrow, if anybody's watching the Arrow series.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that kind of wrecked it for me. I kind of wish I had not watched the show, and actually the show's not very good.
Oh.
It's really kind of just a soap opera for very good-looking people.
Do they have the budget of Game of Thrones?
No, not nearly the budget.
Okay.
You know, but it's not badly done.
Okay.
It's not badly done. But they're digressing now from the book quite a bit, and they're bringing a lot more of the post-apocalyptic
And I don't remember Elfstones much either, but the Elfstones become more important than the sword.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the Elfstones. We didn't really talk about the Elfstones.
No.
Shay getting these Elfstones.
Yeah, they just do a couple magic things.
Yeah, a couple things, yeah. And I didn't get, do they not work against humans, or do they not work against supernatural, or how did that work?
No, he used the Elfstones to originally find their way out of the mist.
Bang, those were the elf stones.
Yeah, helping them find their way, right? Yeah. But then the second time was when they fought the dark creature.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. One of the skull bears.
That's
with
right.
Kelset and with...
No, this
they used them a couple times.
They used them a couple of times.
Oh, before that.
Early on, they used them.
They fought that one Loch Ness monster kind of creature.
Oh, it zapped them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was at one point in the mist. That was close to the mist, too, wasn't it?
Oh, in the mist, you're right.
It wasn't long after it.
It helped them find their way out of the, the forest vision, then the swamp creature. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I thought the next one was with a dramatic one was with a skull bearer with Panem and Creel.
Yeah.
And Kelset.
Right.
Right.
Like big time. Zap, zap, zap.
Now, I would have had those things out All the time.
All the time. Absolutely.
I guess so. I didn't even get that. I'll leave them in my pack. No, I would have those in my hand, and I'd just be walking around like, don't mess with me.
Well, that's good. You're like a scaredy cat.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess so.
But that's why I was wondering if it didn't affect humans.
Oh, yeah, because he could use them more often?
Yeah.
Okay.
But so maybe they don't have any effect on humans. They only have effect on the supernatural creatures or the fantasy creatures.
Yeah,
or something.
He didn't make that clear.
No.
He also didn't make clear why magic was working. You know, this is post-apocalyptic Earth.
Well, it's magic.
Oh.
No, but I know what you're saying, though. In a lot of fantasy books, it's a big deal of where it came from, and how it works, and the physics of it, and, you know, all that. And it just didn't, none of that was in this book. Brandon Sanderson, oh, yeah.
Really he's good with that, how it all works.
Yes.
Is he?
Yeah.
We'll have to have this other guy, Brad, on sometime.
Yeah.
He'll know all that stuff. Well, I know even in the evolution of the D&D playing, the role playing, it's gone from the magic where the magic user has to have it written down and he memorizes it. And then when he casts it, the energy comes out of the brain and the spell's gone.
Ah.
To sorcerer, which pulls on power and forces within the natural world. And he manipulates them in his mind, so he doesn't need to study a spell to know it.
Right.
Okay. He can just conjure it, the magic from... So they've even broken down that within the game system. Probably because of these other authors addressing magic in a more detailed way.
Yeah.
Was Gary, what's his name?
D&D? Terry.
That little
Gary Gygax.
Little guy,
Gary Gygax.
Oh, I thought you meant
was
that
he influenced
TV
by
show.
This book, or did
I thought you meant the little black guy, Gary.
Gary Coleman?
Yeah. Coleman, yeah.
What's you talking about, Willis? What's up with that? What you talking about, Willis?
I couldn't think of what he said quick enough to get it out there to be a joke, so never mind. Sorry, I blew that one. Gary Gygax, yes.
Was he...
Yes.
After the... was he influenced by this book?
His bibliography, boy, it was about the same time. But his bibliography, they will have a literature list in there, and I'd have to double check it.
Okay.
I don't remember seeing it in there. I remember stuff by Jack Vance and...
Well, you guys go ahead and do the story, and I'll check it while you're talking.
Okay. All right, so they've been split up.
They've been split up.
Yeah, and Shay is going off, and they meet with this thief and the other guy, and they finally, the thief who steals the sword.
Right.
Turns out then they've been carrying the sword with them for a while, and this thief steals the sword and goes off, and then they're after him, and they finally figure out, that's the sword of Shannara. We kind of have had it with us, and they go after him, which I thought was kind of... I just felt really bad for them. Honestly, I had an emotional reaction. I thought, man, that is very unfortunate. There's other words I could use. But here they had the sword in their grasp, and they let it go, and then they spent quite a bit of time chasing this guy down with it.
Yes. Now, they eventually found him in the north. Oh, boy. But then, meanwhile, the rest of the party has split up and gone different ways, too.
Yes. So they've gone to alert the cities... About the coming
Balinor and Menin went down to Balinor's city, and that's where the initial attack was from the dark forces, of Brana. So that whole thing was kind of interesting with
it
the river
was.
And
yes,
the first town got wiped out because they didn't really have any fortresses, but then the next town was well fortressed,
right?
A lot of walls and bridges and things.
That I
they
did
had
like
to,
that.
Yeah,
I did
that,
like
that was interesting.
They
evacuated. The whole. And the caves underneath the castle.
Yeah.
And how the enemy was going to sneak in there, but somebody sacrificed themselves, right? One of the dwarf, right?
The dwarf did, yes.
Yeah, to stop that, so.
Right.
Yeah, that, like I said, it got more interesting at the end.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So. And the Shay stuff with his... When he finally gets the sword, I'm drawing a blank now. Where they get it back from the thief?
Right.
But they don't kill the thief.
No, he's
it's fading from my mind even now.
He with the sword?
Yeah. Where? How do they get it back from that one gnome?
They track him through the stormy, the mist, the darkness, the mudslides, the rock trolls had captured him. Rock trolls capture Kelset. Kelset reveals that he's this really cool dude.
Noble,
and he would never lie, which was also a little stilted, right?
Yeah.
But, oh, he has the symbol. Well, now we know he tells the truth. And then he says, this evil dude wiped out my people. We have to turn against him. Mm-hmm. Which was really dramatic.
Yeah. Yes.
Could have been built up more and less time chasing the gnome.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah.
You know, they chased the gnome way too long.
Right.
And too much mud and mist.
There was a lot of mud and mudslides and
skip that. Go to have a flashback to the Dark Lord like wiping out the rock trolls and lying to him.
Right, right.
So then they went in the Skull Mountain. They went in the skull thing from the bottom, or they went in pretending to be prisoners.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right.
Which is all pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
And then they got to where he pulled the sword out, and then that conjured up the Dark Lord.
Right.
Now, the Dark Lord himself, you know, what was he and what was he made of? Well, his when he first appeared, it was like this.
Then the air swirled violently as if wrenching free of the space that held it, and the mist seemed to come together in a huge black shadow that tightened slowly into material form at the edge of the basin. The mist gathered and swirled and became the Spirit Lord, a huge cloaked figure of black that seemed to hang in the air. The sleeves rose, but there were no arms within, and the folds of the trailing robes covered nothing but the floor. The terrified creatures' voices sounded in unison, and their shapes groveled obediently, bent before him. The faceless cowl turned to them and looked down, and they could see within the blackness the tiny glints of flame that burned with satisfied hatred, flashing spark-like in a hazy green mist that hung all about the inner recesses of the shroud. Then the warlock lord turned from them, and they were forgotten as he gazed steadily into the waters of the strange basin, waiting for the commanded mental picture to appear. Seconds later, the darkness was gone, and in its place was the furnace room at Paranor, where the company of Alanon again stood face to face with the dreaded Skullbearer. The fiery eyes and the green mist stared first at the Veilman, then watched the battle between the two dark figures until both tumbled over the edge of the pit and were lost in the flames below. At that moment, a sudden noise behind him caused the Spirit Lord to pause and to turn slightly. Two of his Skullbearers entered the room from one of the dark tunnels of the mountain to stand silently, awaiting his attention.
And so, he comes up like out of the mist and forms, and then these servant dudes are in there, and he's having the visions in the water thing, and that's all pretty cool. And
That's
Dark Lordish, right?
Right.
Yeah. But also different, I felt, a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end there, right, the sword. Now we get to the big reveal.
Finally.
Spoiler alert.
Just much like the elf stones, the sword comes without instructions.
I hate when that happens.
And it's just like, you'll know what to do. You're the only one that can wield it, and you'll know what to do. And I'll be like, sorry, what?
So he pulls it, and he does that whole truth thing. I thought that was pretty cool.
The truth thing.
As a Christian, I think this whole concept about people seeing their faults, you know, it's supposed to be the philosophy of the faith. And people look at Christianity and probably other faiths and think, they're hypocrites. But you only can say that when the people are not truly looking at their own weaknesses and badness and fallenness. Hate to get a little religious philosophy going here, but it ties in because suddenly I'm reading that and it's like, Shay's the good guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's the good guy and he can't stand seeing his own frailties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty brilliant.
That was good.
On his part, because anyone else might go, oh, well, Shay, you know, he looks and he remembers the time he pushed his little brother over when they were little. And that's the extent of it. But it's overwhelmingly mind-numbing to him, right? And then Al-Anon, with not giving him the instruction book, right?
It does whisper in his ear from hundreds of miles away.
Right.
So he does.
Very handy.
And then the Dark Lord tries to, what's his name? Wasn't the Dark Lord, was it?
Brona. Brona?
Brona, the wizard.
No.
The druid.
No.
Yeah, but he had the dark term. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember.
Golly, we are the worst people to do this kind of show. anyway, he tries to shut out Al-Anon's voice.
Yeah.
And then we realize the sword is a sword of truth.
Right.
And then it gets very philosophical, right?
Yeah.
on the Dark Lord, mm-hmm. that Brona.
Yep.
Yes.
That he is a...
He can't handle the truth.
Yes.
Is really what it boils down to.
Exactly.
That he is a lie.
Yeah.
Like, he's a lie.
He's a lie.
And that was pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was good. That was good.
I might steal that for one of my games.
You should. You should.
And it was...
You can leave the Loch Ness Monster behind. You know, you've probably already done that.
Yeah, that, yeah, many times.
And when I read it this time, it was hard on the heels of also watching Excalibur, which is the uh-huh. movie that we're going to review
on next show.
The next show, which is also about a sword of truth. And so, I don't know if he, pulls that specifically from the Arthurian legend. But it could be.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't
but it has some of the same mythological background to it.
Yep.
That, like, this truth thing is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
You got to pay attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I don't remember what he did with that in the second book. But, you know, and then at the end, he leaves the sword. So Dark Lord is destroyed.
The Dark Lord is destroyed. He leaves the sword at Paranor, I think.
Yes, that's right.
For safekeeping. And goes back to the Shady Vale.
Right. Where the Panamon.
Creel. Oh, yes, Creel. Yes. Creel. Yes, yes. At the very end.
Very last page, yeah.
Reappears mm-hmm. to set the stage for a possible next adventure. Yeah. Nice.
And so there we go.
Nice.
So that was Sword of Shannara.
Sword of Shannara.
Done that.
Now we have.
Now we have. Well done. Don't know if we'll do the next one, but we'll see.
So much to choose
from. If enough
from.
People send us money, we will.
do we have a donate button yet on the site?
I'll make sure it's on there.
Let's get that rolling.
Yeah. So I guess that wraps it up.
Well, yeah, I think so, Mike.
Thanks, guys, for reading that.
That's, all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
We'll see you again next time. But until then, keep reading.
Read a book and watch a movie.
That's right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Spine
and sprocket.